You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 161 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Artistic Sensitivity as a Spiritual Approach to Knowing Life in the World. Translated by Rory Bradley. This is Lecture 3, given in Dornach on January 30th, 1915. From the various considerations that we have undertaken here over the course of time, one fundamental thing that emerges is that true, genuine art can ultimately be traced back to the secrets of initiation. We have, at the very least, hinted at this idea when discussing various particular examples. The great artistic epochs, epochs in which art is created that shines its light over all of humanity, always derive their artistic sources from initiation. And with that, we have some indication of how art brings spiritual life into physical life. Initiation opens up the possibility for people to step beyond the physical plane into the spiritual world. And the things that can be experienced and undertaken in the spiritual world, with greater or lesser awareness, are then borne by true art down into the physical forms in which art finds its expression. Now, the whole situation that I am talking about here will be viewed properly only if we pay heed to the fact that the last few centuries of human evolution have really hidden, have made invisible and imperceptible to the vast majority of people, a number of things that just 5 or 6 or 7 centuries ago were not a secret to the same extent that they are now a secret, even to those who consider themselves cultured. In order to point out a very important circumstance, I have selected the Divine Comedy by Dante as an example. It is an artistic work that truly continues to shine, even as time passes. Those who truly give themselves over to the Divine Comedy will be able to see the spiritual course that runs throughout what Dante was able to express. In our time, when it comes to talking about how Dante arrived at the sublime images in his poem, people tend to use the word fantasy and content themselves with saying, quote, oh, yes, artistic fantasy was simply active in Dante, close quote. It goes without saying that artistic fantasy was very active in Dante. But even looking at it historically, that is, in terms of exoteric history, it would be incorrect to believe that Dante created his whole majestic poem out of the void purely through artistic fantasy. Dante had a teacher and friend, Brunetto Latini, and I think that you will recognize in what I am about to say that Brunetto Latini can be called an initiate in the truest sense of the word. That means that if we can identify a connection between Dante and someone who, given the circumstances of his time, was truly an initiate, then we have found the connection that, in relation to what we are looking at today, must be most strongly emphasized. At that time, it was known that if you wanted to get behind the secrets of existence, you had to follow a path that led through a human rebirth. And above all, it was still a very living fact back then that the path to knowledge of the world lay in knowledge of the self. But we cannot think about their concept of self-knowledge in the same superficial way that we tend to think of self-knowledge now. Who does not think that he is in a position to say something about himself? I would like to bring up one small but telling example of how difficult true self-knowledge is, even in the most elementary things, of how little people tend actually to deal with something that can be called self-knowledge. I have here a book by a very famous contemporary philosopher, Dr. Ernst Mach, who has written a series of works that are very characteristic of this time. Already on page 3 of his title, Analysis of Sensations, speaking about the connection between the physical and the psychic, he makes a very characteristic remark. He says, quote, "One day when I was a young man, I took note of a face in profile on the street that was unpleasant and off-putting to me. I was more than a little startled when I realized that it was my own face, which I had seen in two mirrors that were facing one another in a mirror shop." So, he was walking, and his karma took him by a mirror shop, where two mirrors were angled in just such a way that he was able to see himself. And there he saw this terribly unpleasant face, only to discover that it was his own. Even when it comes to what is purely external, it is not exactly easy to achieve even the most elementary form of self-knowledge. This man goes on to make another remark as well. He had become a university professor and had thus developed an idea of how a higher-level schoolteacher looks. Quote, "Before long, I boarded an omnibus one night, exhausted after a very strenuous train ride, just as another man was stepping on from the opposite side. What a pitiful schoolteacher that is," I thought. It was, in fact, myself. For opposite me as I entered was a large mirror." Close quote. By way of explanation, he goes on, quote, "The bearing that I had in the classroom was far more familiar to me than my bearing that night under those circumstances." Close quote. He had formed an imagination of what a schoolteacher looks like, and so he knew that the man who was boarding the train looked like a pathetic version of a schoolteacher. Only afterward did he realize that he was in fact seeing himself. This is a perfect example of how often our self-knowledge is very limited, even when it comes to external appearances. When it comes to self-knowledge of the soul, it is even more complicated. And yet this individual self-knowledge is nothing less than the most fundamental beginning of the path that leads through the human realm into the wide universal secrets of existence. When we observe the world externally on the physical plane, we are seeing only the things that belong to the most external aspects of the human being, that is, to the structure of the physical human body. We can say that when we turn our eyes toward all that we can see stretching out before us to the physical horizon, we are looking at everything that is related to our external physical human bodies. We must be clear that this is only one part of the whole of our being, and that behind it lies an etheric body. But everything that is similar to the etheric body in our surroundings as human beings is not something that we can sense at first. We have even less of a sense of the things that are similar to the astral body, and still less of the things similar to the eye. Each of you, since you are primarily the sole example for yourself of something that has borne evidence out of the spiritual world into the physical one, you must go through your own proof of the spiritual world. Everyone who has experienced some part of initiation has done this, to be sure. Brunetto Latini knew this as well. Now for him, Dante's teacher and friend, it is particularly characteristic, and this happens often, that the process we refer to as initiation was triggered by a very unusual experience. Everyone who proceeds along the path of spiritual science is basically awaiting the moment that comes at one point or another when the gates of the spiritual world swing open, and they will open. It can certainly be the case, and is often so, that the movement into the spiritual world occurs gradually, that we grow slowly into the spiritual world. But it is also often the case that some sort of sudden occurrence, perhaps some sort of shocking or surprising life occurrence, befalls a person and causes the spiritual world to open. Brunetto Latini himself tells how he had been sent as a messenger to the ruler of Castile, and how on the way back he learned that his political party, the Guelph Party, had been driven out of Florence, and Florence had completely changed in his absence. This caused him great despair. This sort of despair in a soul constitution that is suited to the external physical world often serves as a starting place for the entrance into the spiritual world. He goes on to tell that in this state of despair, he did not go home, but instead went into a nearby forest or wood. Recollecting this moment, he had to conclude that he was entirely out of his wits. When he came to his senses, everything was very strange for him. He did not see the typical world of the physical plane surrounding him, but saw instead a formidable mountain rising before him. He did not return to a consciousness oriented to the physical world, but instead returned to a consciousness that was connected to an entirely different world than the one that surrounded him physically. A formidable mountain where things came and went, came into existence, and then faded away again. And by the side of this mountain stood a woman, and things would come into existence and fade away, according to her orders. Brunetto Latini saw the lawfulness of natural occurrences in the form of an imagination. All the natural laws and their lawfulness, the generative, interwoven, essential nature, came forward in that imagination, in the form of a woman who gave orders dictating how and when things should come to be and cease to be. We see here that he was living in the time of the 13th and 14th centuries, the time when natural scientific ways of thinking were beginning to draw closer. Brunetto Latini saw the things that were later given the abstract name of natural laws, things that later people would not want to think about as having any kind of being behind them. He saw them in an imagination, in the form of a woman whose spirit gave off what would later be abstractly called natural lawfulness, but in the form of a commanding word whose nature he also imagined. Then this woman said to him, so he says, that he should deepen his soul forces, because this would allow him to move ever deeper into himself. Now it is interesting that even as she was shining her power down on him, she gave him the opportunity to move ever deeper into himself. This is the process of diving into one's own being. And the sequence of events that he describes is truly the correct sequence of initiation, under certain circumstances. The first thing he learned, he says, were the soul forces. So, by diving down into yourself, you learn to truly recognize the things that would otherwise remain unconscious, your own soul forces. But this knowledge is something that people tend to flee from when they really meet their own soul forces, for it is for it truly is often the case that these soul forces appear unsympathetic to us when we perceive them. And we say to ourselves, quote, "Oh, what a terrible soul this is," close quote. And people do not want to do that. It is just what happened to the good professor when he saw his own figure and it looked downright ugly to him. People do not want to see. In the choir of these soul forces, you will often see something that is a part of you that in your day-to-day life you do not ascribe to. But we see it in such a way that it works upon the whole of our being, on the elevation or also on the degradation of our basic nature, making us either more or less useful for the collective being of the universe. So first we come up against the soul forces. The next stage that you experience is the four temperaments. It becomes clear how we are woven together out of choleric, melancholic, sanguine, and phlegmatic temperaments, and how this interweaving lies deeper in us than do the soul forces. And only after we have passed through the four temperaments do we arrive at what can be called the five senses in the esoteric sense. The way that we normally speak about these five senses refers only to the way that they can be known externally. We know these five senses only from without. We can come to know the senses inwardly only when we have descended down through the temperaments into the deeper regions of the self. Then we see the eyes, ears, and other senses from within. In other words, we experience our own eyes and ears by occupying them from within. We might say that you have to imagine the following. After you have undergone this process of descending into yourself, instead of going through a door into a room and perceiving the objects and people that already are there, you move into the area, so to speak, of your eyes and ears. In this area, you can perceive how the forces operate from within to bring about the acts of seeing and hearing. You perceive a very complicated world, a world that someone who knows only the external physical plane has no inkling of. To be sure, some will say, quote, "This world of the eyes and ears does not impress me at all. The world of the physical plane that surrounds me is large. But there, in the world of the eyes and ears, I am looking down into a little world." Close quote. But this is a maya. What you behold when you are inside your own ear or your own eye, EYE, is much larger and fuller than the external physical world. There you have a much richer world surrounding you. And only then, when you have moved through this region, do you arrive at the region of the four elements. We have also spoken about all the particular characteristics of these individual elements. Only then do you feel that you are within earth, water, air, and fire. Normally, people are familiar with their senses from without, but here they get to know their senses from within. So here you move consciously into the eye from within, then break through the eye and move into the realm of the four elements. The same breakthrough could happen in the ear or with the sense of taste. You are constantly surrounded by these four elements, but you are not aware of what they are like inwardly. You cannot see what they are like inwardly with your external sense organs. Instead, you must first move through the sense organs from within, and then leave them behind, as though you had passed through a set of gates. You must climb into that realm through the eyes and the ears. You must slip through the eye, slip through the ear, and then move into the region of the elements. In this way, you come to know the spiritual element that is living in this realm, the various forms of nature spirits and the beings in the hierarchies that are right beside the human being. Then you go even farther into the region of the seven planets. There you are very far outside. There you learn to recognize the creative forces that are bound together with us in the vast cosmos. And then you must stride across a great ocean, Okeanos, as it has always been known. Soul forces, four temperaments, five senses, four elements, seven planets, ocean. This act of striding across the ocean signifies the following. You can still reach the realm of the seven planets when the last part of your soul being, so to speak, is still present in the physical plane. But when you go through the gate of the senses, through the elements and the planets, then you must finally withdraw the last vestiges of your soul being to arrive at a state in which you are conscious but otherwise asleep. When you are in the realm of the planets, a part of your soul being still resides within your body. When you tug this free, then what you will experience is comparable to having to swim through the universal ocean of spiritual being. Brunetto Latini undertook all of this. He tells how he took each step at the behest of the woman who appeared to him in his imaginative knowledge. Then the woman urged him to go farther. But this admonition came to him at a very particular moment, and this is very characteristic. So, think about this. A man rides into a wood because he is perplexed about everything that has happened in his hometown. He arrives at a state of consciousness that does not lead into the physical world, but rather through all of the regions just described. Then comes the moment for him, and this is not an accident, as some might say, but rather happens at the woman's behest, the moment when he catches sight of himself there in the wood. After he had gone through all of that, after he had journeyed through the soul forces and the temperaments, and had traveled through the sense world into the elemental world, and perceived the rich spiritual life there, after he had perceived the seven planets, and journeyed through them, and the upper hierarchies that enclose each other in ever-widening circles, only then to find that he was no longer on solid ground, but rather swimming in some sort of ocean. After all of that, he awakens in the physical world. And this is the extremely important thing that we see also in all of these initiation processes, that the person in question makes a complete circle, ending up again in the physical world. After everything that he experiences, Brunetto Latini feels that he is once again in the wood. Now he is truly surrounded by all that surrounds him in the physical world. Shortly thereafter, the woman stands before him again. But now he has the physical wood around him as well, and she says to him that he should now ride on the side of right and justice. And she gives him indications about how he can arrive at philosophy, at the four human virtues, and at knowledge of the God of love. Take note of what significance lies behind this. People now would say without hesitation, quote, "Oh, yes, philosophy. I know all about that. I studied the whole history of philosophy. I know what philosophy is and what it teaches. The four virtues, Plato said that they are wisdom, courage, temperance, and justice. And as for the God of love, who doesn't know about him? You need only read the four Gospels. Close quote. In other words, people of our time know it all. But this is what is characteristic about spiritual knowledge. You begin to see that all of this is not actually known, that you first have to journey through an understanding of the spiritual world, and must then return to the physical world as it presents itself. And only then will you understand that physical world. So, if Brunetto Latini were to rise from the dead now, and if a highly educated man of the present were to come to him, let us say, a very famous professor of philosophy, and if the professor were to say, quote, I know all of philosophy, close quote, then Brunetto Latini would answer, quote, yes, certainly you are familiar with it, but in reality you know absolutely nothing about it. First you have to become familiar with the appearance of the suprasensory worlds. You must know what the conditions are there. Then you will return to philosophy, and it will become something altogether new for you. Because only then will you get a hint of what you now believe you know so well. Close quote. The very same thing could also be described differently. Who would not find it absurd to say that a very famous philosophical mind can write a philosophical book that he does not understand? But he must understand it, must he not? If he is writing a philosophical book, how could it be the case that he does not understand what he himself is writing? It is not hard to write books now. They practically write themselves. The things that we have learned to repeat can be arranged in compositions. But to do this, you do not need to penetrate into the deeper meaning of what you are writing. This is the monumental thing that we encounter in Brunetto Latini, that he wants to understand, through spiritual knowledge, the things that others seek to understand through exoteric study. And only after he has made this trek through the spiritual world does he encounter the things that others believe they know through their work in the physical world, the knowledge of philosophy, the knowledge of the four virtues, the knowledge of the God of love. I would really like for you to fully understand what I have just said to you, my dear friends. To be clear, a certain degree of knowledge can be gained without spiritual knowledge. But these things appear in a totally new light, as something altogether different, when you first familiarize yourself with what lies behind the physical world. And because of the example of the connection between Brunetto Latini and Dante, which I cited today as a way of showing how exoteric, artistic creation is connected with initiation, because of this connection, we can see how Dante's great masterpiece is connected with initiation. Dante would not have been able to achieve his unique way of approaching the spiritual world if he had not had Brunetto Latini as a friend and teacher who bore him up into the spiritual world. Every epoch has its own way of seeking the spiritual world. In the centuries that preceded Dante's age, we see in the experiences of many initiates repeated instances of this woman that Brunetto Latini speaks about, repeated instances of being led forward into the spiritual world by a woman. Several initiates in this particular stage of evolution, dating back to the 7th or 8th century, called this woman Natura, the creative force of living nature. Old initiates described this woman, this creative force of living nature, as the counselor of Nous, the principle that guides and creates the world, the wise reason that pervades the world as Nous, and they called this woman a relative of Urania. Whereas Nous is guided out in the cosmos by Urania, it is guided here on earth by Natura. And if you continue to pursue the matter, you can trace it back to a different means by which the initiates of older times sought to draw near to certain secrets of existence. And there again we find this woman in the form of Proserpina, or Persephone, who wove the garment for her mother Demeter. So the imagination of this woman has changed over the course of centuries. But what we must take away from this is that the secrets of initiation have been at work in the ongoing stream of humanity. In order to approach these things properly, it is necessary that we fill ourselves with a living feeling that the forces at work in world events are not only the ones that we can perceive with our external senses and understanding, but also that the spiritual realm is also at work in everything. We must also contend with the fact that what people today and for some time now call spiritual development refers to nothing more than the development of forces that are connected with the physical body. Very often the term spiritual development is used to refer to the development of forces that are bound up with the physical body. This came about over time. We know that in ancient times, clairvoyance was the normal condition under which humans lived. This eventually faded and receded, and what is now called spiritual development is something connected with the physical human body. At the time of the mystery of Golgotha, something entered the evolutionary stream that is so great and powerful that we are only now really beginning to understand it. What people had up to this point was a sort of tradition. The very last gasp of the final remnants of atavistic clairvoyance was used by the writers of the Gospels to record what had happened. But as I said, this was the last gasp. And now we are beginning to truly grasp the first truths about the mystery of Golgotha through our newly developed powers of clairvoyance. We must understand that the coming time will be immersed ever more deeply in the mystery of Golgotha. We are standing only at the very start of this. Nevertheless, we are beginning. But the impulse of the mystery of Golgotha has been active in the world from the moment that the Christ lived out his life on earth. I have often stressed that if the only thing that people have received from Christianity is what they are able to see with their eyes, then they will not have gotten much from Christianity. If the Christ impulse were able to do its work only via what people are able to grasp by the physical senses, then they would have had very little of the Christ impulse during those first ensuing centuries. I have often given two examples, although I could offer many, that allow us to see how the Christ is active in the human soul, in the things that run through the course of humanity's historical development, but that people are not able to know anything about. Because truthfully, Emperor Constantine surely knew woefully little about the Christ impulse, even when he converted to Christianity and made it the state religion. But the victory of Constantine, the son of Constantius Chlorus the Pale, over Maxentius, led to the introduction of Christianity in Rome. The whole arrangement is one in which special forces lay at the base, and as such the Christ impulse was at work in all of it. The Sibylline books were given to Maxentius to advise him. They told him, I mentioned this same example in the lecture cycle in Leipzig several years ago, how he should approach his battle against Constantine's encroaching army. But he also had a dream. Following this dream and the Sibylline books, he left the city with his army, which was 4 times larger than Constantine's, to march directly against Constantine. That was a huge mistake, according to all the laws of strategy. Constantine also dreamed that he would win if he had his army bear the symbol of Christ's cross, which he made them do. It was not the human wisdom with which people were blessed at that time that led to Constantine's victory. It was dreams. But through these dreams, something was actually at work that could not be grasped, that was in fact the living Christ impulse. Truly, the people could not understand what was active within them, active and living, carrying world evolution forward. They could not understand this thing that completely changed the face of Europe at that time. And again, we arrive at a time in which we can see how people squabble over all sorts of dogma, with every ounce of their reason, understanding, and capacity for feeling, over dogma that seems altogether strange to the enlightened people of today. Whether communion should be taken with one element or two, and so forth. We know how ferociously these battles played out, later resulting in Hussitism and Wycliffe and so on. But there were always conflicts like these. They are proof of how little human understanding could reach the true nature of the Christ impulse. But where, in a crucial moment, did the Christ impulse really shine through? I have often made reference to this. It appeared in some form in a shepherd's daughter, the Maid of Orleans. And now we must be clear about the fact that this occurrence is almost like a tutorial in how the suprasensory spiritual forces were at work in human feeling during a period when they were not able to be at work in human concepts. Joan of Arc is a particularly interesting case. Her inner life was open and receptive, but the part that was connected with the physical body was not open. Rather, it was the perception of her etheric and astral beings that was open. But it was open and receptive in such a way that we can, in fact, see in her an analog for initiation. How so? Recall now, if you will, that in a lecture recently we spoke at a pertinent moment about the history of Olaf Ástason, and how he slept through the days after Christmas and awoke only on Epiphany, on January 6th. We noted several things in addition. That during the days when the physical rays of sunlight have the least power, the spiritual power that encases the world is at its greatest. Therefore, it is only right that Christmas should come during the time of year when there is the most physical darkness. In darkness, spiritual illumination comes to those human souls that are ready for it. This is why we told the legend of Olaf Ástason and how he attuned his inner soul life at that moment in just the right way, when the spiritual forces of light from the sun enter the earth aura at the moment when the external force of the sun is at its weakest. These forces took hold of his soul, and during the period of time leading up to January 6th, he truly made a journey that we could call an entrance into the spiritual world. The Maid of Orleans was to be prepared for a great historical mission. The impulses connected with the Christ impulse that flow and weave through the world were to be present in her soul. They were to be there within her soul, but how could they have gotten in there? They would have been able to enter if the Maid of Orleans had ever undergone something in her life similar to what Olaf Ástason had done. If she had slept through the 13 days after Christmas and then awakened on January 6. But she did not do this, at least not as Olaf Asta'son had done it. But then again, in a certain sense, she was in a sleeping state during that time so favorable to initiation, the last 13 days of her embryonic state. Her mother carried her just so that she experienced the last 13 days of her embryonic state in her mother's body during the 13 days following Christmas. And she was then born on January 6th. That is the Maid of Orleans' birthday. So this was a journey undertaken during the precise time in which the spiritual forces are weaving particularly strongly through the earth's aura. And so we need not wonder at the fact that the exoteric documents confirm that the residents of the village ran all throughout the village on that day, January 6, 1412, and felt that something significant had occurred. What had actually happened on that day was really known only later, when the Maid of Orleans carried out her mission. For those who are able to see into the spiritual connections here, it is of tremendous significance that our calendar tells us that Joan of Arc was born on January 6th. The connections in the world run deep, and any enlightened person can also know when the Maid of Orleans was born. He or she need only look in the encyclopedia. But that enlightened person does not really know the first thing about it. Only those who understand the significance of January 6 through spiritual science will be familiar with the full significance of this fact. And so we see ourselves through these two very illuminating examples, how we must go through an understanding of spiritual circumstances, only then to return to the earthly ones and understand them in the fullest sense of the word. I have also presented these considerations to you today to show that what we typically call spiritual culture in our time has grown old, dry, and brittle. Anyone who has any understanding of the deeper impulses that move through world and human evolution must come to understand that we must stand now at a moment of a renewal in which we ourselves will take part, both with our concepts and with our longing for the spiritual world. And the more intensively we are able to imagine that this renewal is needed, the more likely we will be to find opportunities to participate in the work for this renewal. It will no longer be sufficient, in the future, to simply change and reform the old. We are dealing with a radical renewal of what might be called spiritual life. Just as what we mean when we say spiritual science is altogether different from the things that are taught about the spirit in broader circles now, so too will the culture of the future be altogether different from the present culture. And if people now find it easy to think that what spiritual science urges is fantastical and foolish, this means only that these same people would find the spiritual culture of the future to be similarly fantastical and foolish. But in such a period, a rebirth of the human soul life must occur. All of the aspects of human life must live into this impulse toward renewal and rebirth. Everything artistic must again draw near to the process of initiation. And with that, we have spoken the reason for why we must try to make a start at this in our Goetheanum here, which for all its imperfections is connected down to the last detail with what initiation science has to say to us at present. only because the experiences of spiritual science become living in our souls and come to expression in the form of living experience, only because of this do the things that make up this building have any of the worth I mentioned, serving as a starting point for something new and not representing its perfection. We can only hope that things will be understood in this way, and that especially within our circle there is a deep awareness of the fact that there is a connection between the things that we attempted to approach in spiritual science over the years and the things that are contained in every line and detail of our building. Then, when we ourselves are filled by this knowledge, then perhaps our building will be able to say to the world the things that it needs to hear. And then we will be able to look to the future with happiness, a future that must continue to work for ever more perfect versions of the things contained in the elementary, primitive beginnings of the Gertianum. The end of Lecture 3.